The 2014 Defense Authorization Bill contained sweeping changes for how the military conducts its legal affairs. Congress particularly focused on cases of sexual assault, but changes take place throughout the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Joining us with how this will play out in at least one armed service, Army Colonel Max Maxwell. He's the Judge Advocate General's Strategic Initiatives Officer. Colonel Maxwell, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Tom, very much. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today.
All right, so one of the big changes, we'll kind of walk through these as I see them, is in something called Article 32 Investigations, and this seems to place a rather large tax on the Army personnel that it might not be able to fulfill. What's going on there?
Well, the Article 32 is going to change, and obviously Congress changed it. The current regime under the Article 32 is it's a thorough and partial investigation. It's going to become a preliminary hearing that's going to look at probable cause. And as you well know, Tom, Congress decided that as of December of 2014, judge advocates will be the investigating officers at Article 32s. Now, Secretary of Defense had already made a decision to have all sexual assault Article 32s done by judge advocates. So we had already transitioned by policy, but the legislation itself is going to give, I think, some great opportunities for young judge advocates in which to be able to explore and to be able to be part of this, in my opinion, exciting process.
But who has been doing those investigations, or I guess they're leading to the equivalent of grand juries, maybe? Who's been doing it now?
Well, right now, for sexual assault, it's judge advocates. Historically, in the Army, and I can't speak for the other services, but historically in the Army, it has been a line officers. That is a non-judge advocate. And now, judge advocates will do that function. But because it is talking about probable cause, it's looking at how the charges are formed. Judge advocates are a perfect fit, and we have the resources and ability in which to do that. And that is something that we are taking on and positioning towards.
Are there enough of you to be able to take on that new task?
Well, one of the things that our Judge Advocate General is looking at is exactly that. It's resources. It's to make sure that we have the right amount of resources. And the JAGCOR studying and realizing that emerging demands, such as the Article 32, might require additional personnel or reduction in some services, but it would be, I think, premature for me to comment on that because we're still collecting the data. And that's why we study things like that, to make sure that we maximize the resources that have been given to us by Congress.
I mean, in contracting, you have people called contracting officers representatives who are doing the technical legwork on behalf of a CO. Is there any provision that would let, say, a JAG deputize a subject matter expert but work under the auspices of a judge advocate general or a judge advocate?
Well, because judge advocates are unique, because we have dual professions, we are both lawyers and we are all officers. Therefore, the deputizing concept, we haven't really explored that, Tom, but I would think that you begin with a judge advocate, i.e. someone who is a barred attorney. For example, I'm barred from the great state of North Carolina. You have a barred attorney who can then look at these cases to make sure that the appropriate ones go forward and the ones that should be recommended for dismissal are given to that convening authority, the person who is referring the case.
So you've got some time, though, to figure this all out.
Absolutely, and that's what we're in the middle of. We're trying to figure it out to make sure that we have the right resources, and also because you just don't grow an officer. You know, a colonel is different from a captain, and therefore, as we look at our force structure, how we ensure that we've got the right people in the right places to ensure that what the intent of Congress is executed and executed fully and fairly for both the accused and for the victims who have faith and confidence in our system.
Now, getting to the sexual assault case in particular, that whole area of thinking, there's also a provision in the law for special victims counsel. What's changed there with respect to sexual assault victims?
Well,
or alleged?
Okay. And what Secretary Hagel did is in fall of 2013, he created the Special Victim Counsel Program. And there's a very similar provision in the NDAA. These legal professionals, what we're calling special victim counsel, establish an attorney-client relationship with sexual assault victims and are trained to protect the victims' rights throughout the military justice process, from the investigation to the post-trial phase of a court-martial. You know, having a lawyer to protect the interests of a victim will further increase confidence in the system and encourage more reporting. The JAG Corps, the Army JAG Corps, has already trained over 200 special victim counsel in both the reserves and the active component. And that includes places like Kuwait and Afghanistan. So we continue to ensure that these people are trained and ready to assist those victims as they need, as they go through the judicial process within the military.
And the people you're training there, are they both men and women?
They're both men and women, and they are judge advocates. So therefore, those 200-plus personnel are people who understand the military, understand how the military works, but also understand how our judicial process works under the Uniform Code of Military Justice.
We're speaking with Army Colonel Max Maxwell. He's the Judge Advocate General's Strategic Initiatives Officer. And let's move on to Article 60, because that applies here, too, with respect to setting aside sentences and so forth. This is what caused a lot of the consternation in Congress when a particular case, I think it was the Air Force, not the Army, a sexual assault conviction was set aside. What is changing there? What is Article 60, and what's changing?
Well, for your audience, let me first start with Article 60 is the convening authority had pretty much unbridled discretion to set aside a finding or set aside a sentence or do a combination of a variety of things. Congress decided that what they were going to do is restrict that authority of that convening authority. And what Congress has done is sort of bifurcated it into findings. What can the convening authority do under findings? And what can they do under sentencing? It gets a little convoluted and a little legalese of what a convening authority does. But along every step of that way, he is going to have an experienced judge advocate known as a staff judge advocate to make sure he or she, the convening authority, understands what they can do to ensure that justice in that particular case is done. And here we're talking about post-trial and what we refer to as clemency in the military.
Now, this would take away that authority for the worst cases, that is, those that have sentences longer than 6 months?
Yes. Yes, there, and that is where sentencing, if you have a sentence of confinement more than 6 months or a sentence of a dismissal, a dishonorable discharge, or bad conduct discharge, then there are exceptions. And basically, part of the exceptions hinge on whether you have a pretrial agreement or you do not have a pretrial agreement, i.e., did you plead, and whether or not you assisted the government. Let me give you a good example, Tom. If you have a conspiracy and there's two people who have conspired, and one of them decides to help the government after the trial, then that convening authority has some discretion in which to give you clemency because you've helped make sure that justice was done in that particular case.
All right. And then I guess we should also talk about the related statute or Article 120 and 125 that have to do with mandatory sentences. What has changed there under the new law?
Well, certain provisions of penetrative offenses will have minimums. They will have an automatic dismissal. If you're an officer, automatic bad conduct discharge, or dishonorable discharge if you're enlisted, in a minimum amount of time in which you have to serve. So those are become a threshold, very much like what we do currently in the military where you have, for example, premeditated murder. There is a minimum sentence if you are found guilty under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. What we're doing is we're having a baseline so that people will know what is going to be given as a sentence. But obviously, Tom, that sentence can be higher given the aggravating factors that might appear in that case.
So you have been you're a colonel, and so that means you've been in a little while. from your perspective, do all of these changes improve the Uniform Military Code of Justice?
Absolutely. The 2002 NDA strengthens the oversight and accountability of commanders, which is the driving force for our Uniform Code of Military Justice. We're a command-centric organization with the advice and the counsel of an experienced judge advocate, as I have been twice a staff judge advocate myself for Alaska and for Fifth Corps. But it also empowers the victim in the process. All along, though, it ensures that soldiers accused of committing a crime has his or her case fairly evaluated and has the best opportunity possible to put on a defense should those charges go forward. So I sort of take it from 23 years of experience. It's a holistic approach to make sure that we balance victims, we balance process, and we balance the rights of the accused. Having been a defense counsel myself three times in three different assignments, I think that's imperative to make sure that we know that it is about fairness and the impartiality of that process.
Now, everyone's been following, of course, the unfortunate case of General Sinclair. I guess he's going to be sentenced today. We'll know what his punishment is. But there was a change in prosecutors at the late stage, and then they negotiated a plea agreement with the new prosecutors. Do you see that happening, that type of thing happening more in future cases?
I can't really talk to the Sinclair case because it's still an ongoing case. But in the abstract, plea agreements are very common in the military. I mean, we do have plea agreements, but what I have found both from the defense side and from the government side, because we have open discovery, I've also been a fellow at Department of Justice, and in other systems, there's not open discovery, i.e., I as a defense counsel can almost see everything that the government has. So therefore, when you sit down with a plea agreement, you really are talking about making sure that you have a just sentence given what that accused is accused of, what that soldier's accused of. So I think plea agreements will continue to be an engine and to be used by our military for the foreseeable future. And that is good. Now, one of the things that is a provision and one of the things that would change is that now we have a deliberative process to ensure that the victim of that crime is consulted and to make sure that he or she understands what's happening. And that's normally going to come through our special victim counsel to make sure he or she understands what is on the table and whether he or she agrees with it. Now, they don't have a veto power per se, but they certainly have a voice. And that, talking to victim advocates, that is critical to making sure that we are a transparent system.
So it sounds like, to use the popular vernacular, there's a little more transparency in the whole system.
I think there certainly is. And the Army has really led. For example, we have the special victim prosecutors and special victim investigators through CID, our Criminal Investigation Command, to make sure that these cases, especially in the sexual assault arena, are handled by people who have the experience and the wisdom to make sure that they go forward and go forward properly.